Welcome to another week with The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. On today's show, we're going to start off by talking about meeting the parents when you're in a relationship and you have to eventually meet the people who may or may not be connected to that person whom you're dating. From there, we're going to go into an interview that Steve and Candace have with Philip Longman, perhaps not your typical Boundless voice, on the issue of global population. And stay tuned also for our inbox this week, where we'll talk about adoption versus biological children. Is it one or the other? Is it both? Should you be open? Do you not have to be? We will go ahead and weigh in on that. So welcome to Mott, Steve, Candace, and myself.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Lisa, everyone. So anyway, this weekend, as many people know from my blog post last week, I was at a conference in Kansas City and speaking at a women's conference there, doing a workshop, which was great on mentorship. I was excited that everyone got worked up about the subject of mentorship, and I plugged Candace's book like a good soldier and
thanks,
a good
Lisa.
Friend. So pat on my own back for that. But as part of that, it was interesting. This guy that I've been dating, his family lives out there, and so I went to dinner with them on Saturday night.
Nice.
He was not there. He had did the courtesy of getting wrist surgery on Thursday, so did not make the trip and apparently had no intention to. So I went out solo with them, not only the parents, but the brother and the sister-in-law.
Well, that's kind of a neat opportunity.
It was interesting.
To, you know,
but you know what? They took me to barbecue, Kansas City. So I was just like, I don't even care if these people are totally rude. I'm just going to eat barbecue. So so that was a definite plus.
It helps to have food you love.
Exactly.
But that is unusual to go out there without even being with the guy you're dating. That's a different setup.
It is, and I think I need a round of applause for that. And I'm just going to pause while all of you listening right now do that. So, yeah, but it was good. It was interesting, though, because I am usually pretty social and I'm an extrovert. Everyone at the table was not. All introverts.
Oh, boy.
And, so it was kind of fascinating, but a great conversation. And you could tell that they were really stepping up. Like, they were really making an attempt. They probably went home and just expired. Like, they just haven't talked now for 4 days because of all the interaction. But I think it was a good conversation. But I obviously have just had this recent experience, but you all can weigh in on experiences that happened perhaps with people that you dated prior to meeting your current spouses, as well as the current in-laws. And we just thought it'd be a good discussion starter and something that many folks at Boundless are probably dealing with or anticipate dealing with, because I'll just start out by saying, is it true that you eventually have to get to know and ultimately, quote unquote, marry the family? What is that phrase? What does that mean? What's the implication?
Yes and no. I mean, it is one of the most, I think, traumatic, most dreaded parts of dating someone, especially if you live far away. And so you don't have any natural, sort of week to week, day to day opportunities to interact with the family. And so it's a big deal because you have to pack a bag and make a trip. And then that means you're having an intense overnight situation where you're there for two or three nights for a weekend usually, and you've got to come up with activities and conversation for a long period of time, and that can be pretty stressful.
Yeah, I would just be curious how many people have a better than expected experience. I mean, I wonder how many people had the experience Candace and I had, where you go in with a certain hope and then you almost can't help but think, how did this person come out of this family?
That's right.
How did this person that I was attracted to evolve from this setup?
Well, and that's especially true if you're dating if your boyfriend or girlfriend has now lived away from home for a while, because they've taken on some new characteristics of the place they're living. They've traveled. And in the case of Steve and I, we went to a small town, his small hometown, where the rest of his family hadn't ever left. And so it was just sort of a culture shock to me, especially because it was a whole different region of the country. And so I'm having to deal with the Southernisms that I'm not used to, on top of relational dynamics. And honestly, I have to say, after meeting his parents, who were just so gracious and loving and excited to meet me and did everything they could to make me feel welcome, I wrote in my journal that night, I can never marry into this family.
Whoa.
Well, I think that's okay. A good testimony that you shouldn't make those decisions after you meet their family.
Right, you need a little cooling
exactly.
off period.
It's like you need
when you
to
buy a gun,
something like
you need
that.
A 24-hour waiting period.
No, I think it's a great reminder that initial experience means a lot. There's a lot you can learn from, but it shouldn't be the last word. I think anybody who goes into it and thinks this is a disaster, they can't immediately think, and therefore we can never marry. But on the other mm-hmm. hand, Candace and I have shown that we've made it for 11 years and we have a good marriage, and we got past that point.
Yeah.
So I think what I've
and we
come
moved
to.
We moved to a galaxy far, far away.
No, but I think we could have even found a way to coexist close by, even
closer.
Though we had some big distinctions. Yeah. I think probably as I've chewed
with a certain
on
amount
it,
of barbiturates.
As I've thought about it, I think the tension there that you have to keep in mind is that it is meaningful. It can tell you a lot about how you're becoming one and the families you're bringing together and becoming one. But it should not be a deal breaker in the reality that we are supposed to leave and cleave,
yeah.
and that we are supposed to create a new family. Mm-hmm. And so becoming one with your spouse does mean you are taking on their family, but it doesn't mean that you're locked into everything about that family, because you're also responsible to leave and cleave and become a new family.
And Lisa, I think you were at a disadvantage because the person you're dating wasn't there, because one of the benefits is seeing how that person interacts with their own family. And it can be very informative, like Steve was saying, and helpful.
Well, and not only how he interacts with his family, but how with his family there, he interacts with you. Because
yeah.
does he suddenly seem like a different person, and you're going, who is this guy? You know, is he reverting to mm-hmm. being a boy again, being mama's boy or daddy's son, or not able to speak up for himself? Or is he able to really, are you sensing that he's pulling more toward you and the two of you are working as a team?
Yeah.
And that's not going to happen overnight. We've got an article on Boundless about hope for the man he'll become, for people to see the potential for someone to grow into a mature, godly spouse. But I think that's also the case for meeting the parents. It's going to be culture shock the first time. There is going to be a sense
awkwardness.
Of
awkwardness.
Yeah, this is a lot of times this is the first time where people have awareness that they are going to have some separation from the thing that's always been everything they've known. And so that first time isn't going to tell you everything. I think the second time and subsequent times, and especially how you handle the conversations about it, are going to be a lot more informative about your ability to recognize this is what it is, this is what we've inherited, but this is our attitude about how we're going to become one and how we are going to leave and cleave and have a distinct family element within the family element we've inherited.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's common for one or the other of the people in the couple, so the boyfriend or the girlfriend, to have a more strong reaction to the other's family. So in Steve and my case, I was the one who had a strong reaction to his family, but then I assumed wrongly, but you know, I guess this is just typical, that he would just adore my family because they were so normal. And I mean, literally, the day I met his family, I was pointing out the flaws. And then we meet my family, and I'm saying, well, aren't they great? And I think it took me 3 years to acknowledge that maybe some of the things he tried to point out early on were actually true.
Yeah, we joked at the time that my family puts the fun in fundamentalism and Candace's family puts the fun in dysfunction. And I think each of us saw in our initial visits a lot of those distinctions, and obviously the one who was the insider saw it with rose-colored glasses.
Well, love-colored. You have a grace that comes from loving your family that the boyfriend or girlfriend doesn't have, because these are strangers to them.
Yeah. And since we're talking about experiences, I was one of those, Steve, that had a good experience when I met Beth's family for the first time, and it was because they were so active. They are from Colorado Springs, and Beth's dad had a list literally of 15 things that we were going to do over a period of 4 days. And so we
no time to be bored.
Because they didn't want to be stuck talking to you for that long. They're like, let's do something with them.
And they are introverts, but they love activity. And it was a really good time, and I thought very well of them.
Later,
conversely,
you found out.
Conversely, Beth had some reservations upon meeting my family from the South.
I'm sensing a theme.
Well, my dad enjoys making people feel uncomfortable. I mean, he thrives on that.
Oh boy!
And so it was a bit. It made for an awkward trip because I was apologizing for him and things like that. But even my mom, Beth, you know, reservation is a kind word, but she loves my mom now. Mm-hmm. They're very close, and so those initial impressions aren't always what you're going to end up with. Yeah. My wife and my mom are close, and they have a great relationship.
Well, I think good. The key is just to pray for a ton of grace going into it, and just acknowledge ahead of time it's going to be awkward. Anytime you meet someone for the first time, you don't have that that sort of social lubricant of knowing and having anything in common. And so to talk about it as a couple before you go into it, to say, what are we going to do if it's awkward, or what are we going to mm-hmm. do if there are rough moments? How can we be a team and go into this as a unit?
You know, I think I would close by saying too, don't go into it with the mindset of, you know what, we know this is going to be lame and we don't like each other's parents and we're just going to spend the rest of our lives avoiding them as much as possible. Because you might be able to pull that off during a dating period. You might be able to pull that off in the early years of marriage. But family just gets woven more and more into a new marriage when kids come along.
Yeah.
And you need that and you want that. And so as much as possible, even though you might have a cultural mindset of, let's just be lone rangers here and let's go off into a remote island and keep as much distance from our families as possible, it's something you got to tackle. You got to take it head on, go into it and deal with the issues, and sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. I think that's good. I think there are definitely you need to weed out the differences between just quirkiness and things that maybe, you know, could find out that may be concerns, you know, and find ways to talk about those and deal with them and see how, you know, has there really been a separation there that's healthy, you know,
Are they in the mafia?
Are they?
Well, certainly if there's exactly. If you suspect alcoholism or abuse or something that really does mm-hmm. rise to the level of a major red flag to, at a minimum, be able to talk openly with your boyfriend or girlfriend about that and say we might need to get some, you know, extra counseling, premarital counseling, because mm-hmm. those are serious concerns.
Yeah. But to be okay on some levels with the quirkiness. Like in this instance, he has a grandma who is 100 and she couldn't make it to the dinner, but she lives with the family. And so we had to take a group picture so they could bring a picture back to Nana. Aww. And then on my side, my sister and brother-in-law live here in town. And so he's already had the chance to interact with them several times. And my sister is extremely loud and very disorganized and wears hemp clothing and is up in people's business and asks totally personal questions. And I think he's done a pretty good job interfacing with her as a whole when that would not at all be his normal gravitational pull towards someone of that nature. So it's all good. But, well, excellent. Well, hopefully we'll have helped a few people here who are going to be facing that situation, the meeting itself. And I will just recommend that if you can go out for barbecue, it can heal all wounds and it just definitely improves your situation overall.
At least numb the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And get the beans, because that helped me, I'm just going to say.
That'll add to more family memories.
That will, exactly. So, all right, well, great.
Segment. I'm Candace Waters filling in for Lisa Anderson, and it's just a real privilege to be here in the studio with Steve, my better half. Yeah. And today we have Philip Longman with us. And Philip is an author that we have referred to quite a bit on Boundless every time we talk about making babies, which is something that comes up frequently. So today we've brought the man here, the author of The Empty Cradle, who's going to talk to us a little bit about family formation and demographic trends in our country and other countries. But beyond that book, Philip Longman is an award-winning author and formerly a senior writer and deputy assistant managing editor at U.S. News & World Report. He's also written numerous books and is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and research director of the Next Social Contract Initiative. He's here from Washington, D.C. today. Philip Longman, it's great to have you in the studio.
It's a pleasure to be here, Candace.
One of the things that Steve and I enjoyed so much about your book was the surprise of finding such common ground on these issues that we care so deeply about. We come to them largely from a faith conviction of wanting to be fruitful and multiply, the Genesis mandate. You come at it from a very different approach, and yet we come to some of the same conclusions. And so mm-hmm. why don't you talk to our listeners, many of them who would say, no, we really do still have too many people, and how dare you? How could you be so silly to think that we should be out there having kids? This is just mm-hmm. a crazy world. And you mm-hmm. know, why would you guys stand by that position?
Right. Well, you know, all of us who are of a certain age, who are kind of raised under the spell of the population bomb, and hearing about, you know, which was a bestseller of the 1970s that convinced a lot of folks, particularly on the left, that there was just a surplus of humanity and that we were going to be facing this Malthusian nightmare of starvation and civilization breakdown. And, of course, it didn't happen yet. And while not much of anybody was paying a whole lot of attention, this great big mega trend started in the world. You know, it's happening in rich countries, it's happening in poor countries, it's happening in Christian countries, especially happening in Islamic countries. It's happening under all forms of government. And this trend is that people are having fewer and fewer children. The most dramatic declines in fertility are where you would least expect it, in the Middle East, for example, and in the developing world generally. And so we have entered a sea change in 21st century demography, where the tendency of population is not to explode, but to implode, particularly in areas of the world such as Japan, China, all of Europe, all of Russia, and good parts of Latin America, the Caribbean. We're all seeing in these areas people having fewer children than the numbers needed to sustain population over time.
Now, population is still growing in a lot of those areas and worldwide, and we hear the numbers about just how much population is going to grow again over the next several decades. So how can that be that we're seeing mm-hmm. that kind of population growth if you're saying the reality is we're having a drop-off in children?
Okay. Well, start with the concept of a replacement rate fertility. In the United States, for us to have a stable population over time, the average woman needs to have 2.1 children. Where's that number come from? One child to replace herself, one child to replace her partner, and a tenth of a child to make up for those children who don't, for one reason or another.
It's always those tenth of a children that are hard to have.
Yeah, I know.
That'd be a lot easier to be pregnant with a tenth of a child than a whole baby.
That's right, meaning me. But you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. It all comes on the averages. And so you need this. That's where that point went. There's a certain percentage of children do not survive to reproduce themselves. So, and right now in the United States, the fertility rate is just short of 2.1. So compared to any other industrial country, we are actually in good shape on this front. Now, how can population continue to grow if fertility rates are below replacement level? The answer is we had tremendous population growth, particularly in the third world, during the 70s and the 80s, which means that today we have a huge portion of the population that is in their reproductive years. Right, roughly 15 to 40. What this means is even though people are having dramatically fewer children in places like Egypt or Pakistan, the population for now is still growing because of that momentum effect from the past. Mm-hmm. But what we are now right on the cusp of is a dramatic decline in the percentage of world population that can have children, right?
Right.
So to take an extreme example, in Italy, the number of women of reproductive age in Italy today is half what it was in 1960. Mm. This means that if every woman goes out and has twice as many children as her mother had, population still declines. So we're looking at a momentum effect that can cause, as strong as it was in driving up population in the 20th century, And it was very strong. World population has doubled in my lifetime, tripled in my parents' lifetime. Because of the loss of this momentum effect, you slide down the other side of the curve just as profoundly.
Mm. Now, how much of that momentum early on was because of health improvements?
It was almost all health. A demographer friend of mine likes to say, you know, it wasn't that they were breeding like bunnies, it's that they stopped dying like flies.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Which is kind of cruel, but we made tremendous advances in improving infant mortality in the third world. Little things like getting a sewer system, pasteurizing your milk, things like that, you know, this makes a tremendous effect. And that, frankly, is what happened in the United States, but it happened 100 years ago.
Mm. Right.
Now, what's the problem with the idea of fewer children? Is it a bad thing to have an aging population, to have more growth among elderly than the young?
It presents all kinds of challenges and encumbrances. If we were just to let current trends run their course, you know, Social Security, no change in policy, Medicare, no change in policy, no changes to the healthcare system, you know, we would be talking about a younger generation coming up that would be facing such a tax load that they really, really, really would have trouble having children, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we already work, all of us, until March, sometime in mid-March, to pay for the cost of our health care, mm. right? That's like healthcare freedom day
is
March 15th, right?
And that's bad enough.
That's bad enough. Yeah. But on current trends, we're looking at you know, people working half the year for health care. Hmm. Not all of that is from population aging, but in the absence of tremendous reform, you know, we are going to encumber what few kids we have with such burdens. I mean, we already have.
Now, what happens, too, in a culture where more and more people are older? What does that do to their tolerance for risk and trying new things and innovating? Mm-hmm. I've heard, like in Japan, for instance, that they're growing increasingly conservative and not as risk tolerant. That's affecting their ability to grow. Is that right. something you're seeing?
Well, I'm old enough now that I can say these things without being ageist, you know. But as you come into middle age, your priorities and incentives change. You can no longer take the risks with your careers and with your savings than you could as a young person. Mm. The biology of it is there are some things that we get better at as we get older to a point, but creativity, real creativity, is generally in the province of the young, mm. right? You look at Nobel Prizes for physics. At what age were these folks doing the work for which they got the prize? Mm. A lot of, you know, physicists are washed up at 24,
oh,
right?
Wow.
And then we have this correlation you can see around the world that levels of entrepreneurialism are highest where you have youthful populations mm. and lowest. So, for example, India is a highly entrepreneurial country. The percentage of people who are planning a new business in the next year, when you ask them this, it's mm. India's off the charts. France mm. is like the least mm. after wow. Japan, right?
Wow.
So I think what that says is that we have to put a lot of effort into productive aging and to make all of us trying to preserve both our health and our mental abilities to compensate for this lack of youth mm. And the creativity that they always bring to society.
Wow.
In view of that and what you've said about the environment, I'm still puzzled. There are some very influential leading voices out there right now who seem heavily invested in perpetuating the myth of this population bomb. What possible benefit are they hoping to gain from keeping people from having at least 2.1 children?
Well, I think, you know, among the population controller crowd, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, I go to the conferences and I speak to them, and I think there's a lot of soul searching. I think Paul Ehrlich's a good example. He's a man of science. You know, he started off studying butterflies,
oh,
right?
Wow.
That's what he knows about is mm-hmm. the breeding habits of butterflies. Huh. And when the data changes, he starts to change. You know, what's still true is that because all of us are living so much higher on the hog, and in particular, you know, you see an emergence of new middle classes in the China and elsewhere, mm-hmm. that the burden that we're putting on the planet, the footprint, is big, but it has nothing to do with population per se. It has to do with how we conduct our lives. Are we thrifty? Do we conserve? Okay. Or do we think, right? So there really shouldn't be any, it's a false choice, a false opposition between can people have the family sizes they want and can we preserve the planet?
And so when you speak to a colleague whose attitude is almost people are the problem and the solution is fewer people, get rid of people, you're coming back and saying, no, there is a way that you can have family and people can be productive. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. The tragedy in our time, and your younger viewers, I'm sure, will resonate with this, is that it's such a typical story that you're not done with school, with college or graduate school, before your own biological fertility begins to decline or your partner's does. Mm. Then you got to scramble to start some sort of career, both of you, right? And then you wait for the moment when you finally feel that you are secure enough that you can begin to make compromises with your career. Maybe stay home with the child, but even short of that, just get on a mommy track of some kind, right? Mm. And what if so many folks discover? I discovered it in my own life that now that I'm set and ready to be a parent, too late, too late. You know, female biological fertility begins to decline very dramatically after 25. Our society doesn't want to accept that truth. It can't handle that truth.
Because that's already, that's even before the average marrying age.
Yeah. So in terms of solutions, we have to think, where is it written that you have to be in graduate school during your prime productive years, right? And during the years when nature wants you to have a child. We need a society that does not discriminate against young folks who take the choice to form a family when nature wants them to form a family, right? Because right now we discriminate against them big time.
So in view of such bleak statistics and bleak socioeconomic predictions and even just the human relation element, you know, the human element of being lonely and being a woman who is devastated by infertility, what in the midst of all of this research you're doing, if anything, gives you hope?
Well, cultures learn. They learn from their mistakes. And the particular way it happens is younger people in any given era look at how their parents lived and see what was good about it and see what was bad about it. If you were a young woman of my age, you know, 50-something, your mother probably told you something like, don't make the mistakes I made in my life. I got married too young. I had all these kids. I never had a career. Then dad left us, and now I have nothing but this Social Security pension. And just whatever you do, you know, put yourself first. Don't settle, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now comes along 20-somethings today. What are they likely to hear from their mothers? Don't make the mistakes I made. Don't put it off. Don't be too picky. Right?
Find a good man and marry.
Find a good man and marry. So that's how cultures learn.
Well, I appreciate the hopeful note because I know having blogged some about Demographic Winter on Boundless Line and having had some pretty heated debates there about family size and adoption and fertility and others, it's wonderful to have you here to give us that hopeful perspective. And so for everybody listening and for those of you who have read some of our references to Philip Longman's work on boundless.org, we have the ability to learn from our mistakes, and therein lies much hope. And we also, as followers of Christ, have the added bonus of being able to read a book that says, be fruitful and multiply, and shows the joys and the wealth of having children. And so get out your Genesis, read some Genesis 1 and 2, but also pick up a copy of The Empty Cradle and read Philip Longman's book, because there is much scientific data there that will affirm what I think some of your inklings, your inner longings, and some of those desires are fan those flames for forming families and forming them well and having children. Thank you so much, Philip, for being in the studio today, and we just really appreciate your time and wish you safe travel back to D.C. and just all the best in this work you're doing. It's very important work.
Thank you, Candace. Steve.
Thank you.
Saturday, my sister Rebecca got married. She looked beautiful, of course, with her stunning red hair and brilliant smile. As I stood on stage holding my red rose bouquet and studying the delighted face of her groom, I thought about how fast the time has flown since Christmas, when whispers of a relationship with Ezra began. And March, when we were in New York and we felt like Ezra was with us due to the constant buzz of incoming text messages. And May, when Becca called me to tell me they were engaged. Many people have asked me how I feel about having my baby sister, who is 9 years younger than me, marry while I am still single. I'm guessing others have not had the courage to ask. I'm not sure my reaction is typical. Of course, there is the usual sentimentality that sets in when you are part of a wedding or watch a really good chick flick. When I listen to my brother sing the beautiful love song he wrote for the wedding, I sigh and get a little misty. But my primary feelings about Becca's marriage are joy and hope. I feel a lot of joy because Becca has married a godly man who exhibits a love for her that reflects Christ's love for the church. For many years, I have prayed for Becca that she would walk devotedly with the Lord and find a partner who encourages her in her faith. At the beginning of their dating relationship, Becca asked me if I had any recommendations for devotional books. At Ezra's prompting, she wanted to become more serious about her time with God. I was touched by the way Ezra was already leading Becca spiritually. I think some people assume that I would be discouraged by the fact that my little sister got married before me. After all, I have waited 9 years longer than she for a godly spouse. I won't deny that an occasional question of God's fairness has crossed my mind. But by His grace, Becca and Ezra's journey has encouraged me in a profound way and renewed my hope. Before Ezra came along, I watched Becca struggle through several not-right relationships. Nothing was really wrong with them, but they were clearly not God's best. When I see Becca and Ezra together, it is apparent each of them believes they have found a treasure in the other. They bring out the best in one another and desire God's good in each other's lives. As I've watched their story unfold, I have witnessed what the giver of life can do through a relationship he ordains. A few days ago, as I stood on stage watching my parents and Ezra's parents pray for my sister's marriage, I thought, this is a really beautiful thing. A holy thing. It's the thing I'm praying for and waiting for in my own life. I recognize that He is writing different stories for my sister and me, both of them for His glory. He has blessed her with Ezra in this season because that is what she needs, or perhaps He just wishes to delight her in this way. And I have no reason to doubt that God can and will do the same for me in His timing. I'm not trying to claim a promise that doesn't exist. I am only encouraged by this outpouring of God's love and grace on my sister, and I'm trusting He desires to lavish His love on me, too. Today, you may not yet be the bride or the groom, but I hope you will be encouraged that God is great and that He loves you, really loves you, more than you can comprehend. After all, isn't that what weddings are really about? Ephesians says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her." And that's a beautiful thing.
are going to delve into some controversy for this week's Boundless Inbox. I have with me in the studio Steve and Candace Waters to address a question from Lou. And let me go ahead and set up the scenario, and then you two can start by weighing in. So Lou says, I'm a 21-year-old college student. I feel really blessed because God has made it clear to me from the time I was 12 that He wants me to adopt all of my children. I will never give birth. Not passing on my genes to the next generation doesn't bother me, but I have a problem dealing with the attitudes of people around me when they find out I don't want biological children. They often think I'm rejecting God's plan for humanity to go forth and multiply. They don't get how, as a woman, I have no desire to get pregnant and give birth. They ask me whether I wouldn't prefer to have my own children first and then adopt, as though I must be rejecting my true desires and wanting to give orphans a home out of the goodness of my heart. I feel like I'm always confronted with the attitude that adopted children are second best to biological children. So my question is this: how can I respond to them in love and help them to understand that this is a perfectly acceptable and godly desire to have?
This is such a great question, Lou. Thanks for sending it in. And I just want to commend you for your heart for the orphan. You know, scripture is clear that true religion is to care for the orphan and the widow. And with over 127,000 children just in the U.S. and 130 million worldwide who are waiting to be adopted, it's no small need. And so the fact that you already know you want to open your home and your heart and your future family to orphans is a commendable, wonderful thing. Now, the thing that concerns me is a couple of things, really. One, you say you have no desire to get pregnant, that God has been telling you since you were 12 that you never will give birth. And this other curious thing, that you're having multiple conversations with other believers about this. So it sounds from your email like you're not married yet. And so the first thing you need to do is take a step back and ask the Lord to not only speak to your heart about your desire to have or not have biological children, but to give you a biblical perspective on what it means to become one with a man. Because when you're married, this won't just be about you and your desire. This isn't just a woman's choice. This will very much have to do with what your husband wants.
Well, and Lou, I would also point out that marriage, even though we don't popularly like to describe it that way, but as God designs it, there is an openness to children. And you've demonstrated an openness to be a parent, and you have a special heart for adoption. But it sounds like to be able to say absolutely yes to adoption, absolutely no to biological children, means that you're going to go through extra effort to stop the conception of children. And I know there are different theological positions on this, but both left and right on this position agree that Christian marriage means an openness to the possibility of children. And you're slamming that door so tightly closed, even though you might sense that God is leading you to do that, seems in some ways contradictory to His design for family. And so as much as I want to applaud the embrace of adoption, and there is such a great need for it, and it sounds like you've got a great heart for it, it really shouldn't be one at the expense of the other. That having the heart for adoption and embracing that so closely doesn't mean that you therefore have to close the door on the possibility of a biological birth.
And scripture is clear that when you're married, it's a one flesh union, that your body is no longer your own. And we know from Genesis through Revelation that part of the design of marriage is biological fruitfulness. Added to that is the imperative for Christian wives to submit to their husbands, to fit in with the desire that a husband has. And so I think I would just caution you not to be so dogmatic on your decision about this, especially prior to meeting your future husband. It's possible God will bring you a man with the same desire to just adopt. But as Steve said, the only way to make sure that you never have children is to take on a self-inflicted barrenness. And nowhere in Scripture is that commanded. Nowhere is it set up as a calling. And actually, in Scripture, barrenness is always seen as a curse.
Yeah, barren. I mean, God opens and closes the womb. And so if God has closed your womb, then the other doors that He opens are a testimony to His ability to redeem any situation. But God never specifically calls anyone to close the door in order to accomplish His purposes. He always opens and closes the womb as a way of demonstrating His sovereignty.
To just quickly answer your final question about lovingly sharing this desire, I think it's appropriate and commendable, as we said earlier, to share your heart for the orphan. Maybe you would just add, and even pray for this if you don't feel it, to say, Lord, maybe this is your way of preparing me. Maybe I'm infertile and I won't know that until I'm married. And if that's the case, he's done a great work of prepping you ahead of time to be open to having your children through adoption. And if that's the case, you know, all the more glory to God for giving you that early insight and window onto how your life would pan out. But I would just go along with what Steve said, and instead of saying I will never bear children, to say, you know, I have such a heart for adoption, I often wonder if maybe I won't be infertile, and if that's the case, I'll just fill my home with babies who are already born.
Well, and I would just add in closing that as much as people who are able to have biological children should always have an open heart for adoption, that you never know how God might want to use any parent to provide a home for an orphan, that at the same time, as you have a heart for adoption, that you also retain an openness to the possibility of biological children, even though that might not be where your heart currently is.
All right. Well, I'm sure this will spark quite the discussion amongst those of you out there. Thank you, Steve and Candace, for weighing in. And as always, write to us, editor@boundless.org, or give us a call on our line, 1-866-687-8686. Again, that's 1-866-687-8686. This has been a great week. I'm just pleased that we had so many conversations on so many varied topics. And as always, we will be back with you next week. This is The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Have a great week, and we will see you around next time.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.